What happened to the car?
What do you think happened?
Looks like it was chewed up and spat out.
Perhaps it was a result of anxiety.
Okay, there we go. So it's sorry, I just wanted to make sure that the microphone was on. There we go. Okay, so it's been a while, if you couldn't tell by that nonsense. And I just wanted to have a live stream to catch everyone up on what I've been working on. I know that I've made some videos kind of reading things and elaborating on things, but there's a project that I had which I put on hold, and then there's a project that I've been actively working on that I'll talk a little bit about. It's one of those things where I don't want to give too much away, but at the same time it is what I'm doing, and I don't want to disappear from everyone's lives for 2 years while I'm doing it. So I guess first, let's go ahead and start with just going over some of the smaller things. Let me see if I can. Share one of my screens here. All right, let's start over here. Okay, so I've been working on the website a little bit. And if you're watching the stream, you can see it. If you can't, it's just therightpodcast.org. I streamlined it. I narrowed it way down. I tried to do a link library, and I got a lot of really great feedback. And it became just too much administratively, so I took it out. But so it's much more streamlined now. It has links to all of the socials, as well as different platforms where you can watch and listen. But what I wanted to show you is over on the store. It's not really a store. It's a link that sends you out to an exterior site. I haven't done it already, but I'm going to upload a PDF that you can just download. And it has a QR code on it. So this would be something, if you're so inclined, if you think some of the past videos have been worth it, or if you'd like to spread the word, I guess. I know I'm not the best with advertising, but long story short, I just use Zazzle, and there is a QR code. You can put this on anything you want. It doesn't have to be on these stickers. But again, I'll also upload a PDF, so you can just print it out for free if you want to as well. Again, I'm atrocious at advertising. I'm not interested in it, but at the same time, it is kind of nice to spread the word a little bit, especially on some of these videos that I made a few months ago or a year ago that were really, really in depth. So this might help spread the word a bit, especially as our social media platforms implode on each other and turn into Chan boards. So there's that, first of all. Anything else on this site? I do have a blog. You guys might have seen it. I haven't updated it in a while, but it has some old pictures, some travels, some volunteer work I did in the past. I'll put a post up pretty soon because it's been a second. And then lastly, I just wanted to show, because it's not really something that I talk about a whole lot. Sorry, I thought I had this up, but let me see if I can find it really quick. And if I can't, then I'll find it and put it up. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, it's gonna be buried. That's okay. I'll bring it up, but I was going to show, actually I could just do this. I was going to show the Substack, because that's where I've been doing a lot of my stuff at. There, let's see if this links out. Yeah, it does. There we go. So if you're looking for things, I know I haven't been doing a lot of videos, but I do have things going on over on Substack. I just put out an article for New Year's Eve, and then I put some old things out as well. And then some of the video or some of the articles that I've done videos about. So kind of like long story short, why is this? Because I came out and I've been doing all these videos and, you know, I guess, you know, the question is what happened, right? Why did I stop? And I'll talk about that. So what happened was I had a lot of feedback from people saying, look, the videos are great, but you got to write some of this stuff down because things are just getting lost in them. And there's a lot of great stuff that you're doing. But people are just, you know, it's a very niche market for people that can be watching 3 or 4 hour videos. So, you know, I took that to heart and I started working on a video that I want to talk about because it's actually a project I still plan on pursuing in the future. I think it's really interesting. I think that maybe timing wasn't the best for it. But I also think that medium, you know, might not have been the best either. So, long story short, I have over 262 slides created for what was going to be a video. And then I stopped because, it was going to be, you know, multiple videos that would be multiple hours. And, you know, I showed it to some people that I respect and they're saying this should be a book, you know, you shouldn't or something, but don't, maybe not video or video and a writing. So, you know, I paused on it and I did start putting a book together and I didn't get that far. I only got like, I don't know, maybe 120 pages in or something. And I kind of, I did the thing that people do. I changed course midway into what I'm doing now. So, I want to talk about that project. I want to talk about what I'm doing now. And I want to talk about some of these articles. That's probably going to be all the time that I have tonight, but I will start having these on more of a regular basis. And I think what I'd like to do instead of having big overviews is really hone in on very small, like niche areas to focus on. So I'm just going to start going over this project that I had and talking about it, why I put it to the side, but why I think it's important and why it's something that I'm still going to pursue, right? And then I'm going to move on to what I'm doing now. So yeah, a PowerPoint slide, 260 something slides long. And the goal was to really focus on aspects of the left, right, and syncretic politics in reaction to what happened on October 7th. And the project became too big. So things were going to get lost in the videos, et cetera. But there's a lot to consider with it. And it's kind of where, you know, I did have some videos going about the lead up to October 7th. And I want to have time to put together, you know, a kind of like a capstone to that, because what I'm more interested, there's already lots of great coverage out there about what happened, different interpretations of why it happened. And of course, that was a long time ago now as well. I'm really interested in viewing the reactions from specific groups of people and specific organizations and kind of comparing that to what was happening online, especially on social media platforms. So there's a lot to consider in how I want to approach that, particularly in terms of how different factions, I guess you could say the left and right, responded. I think, you know, I'm always more interested in the left because I am of the Western left and I find it fascinating to kind of self-reflect in ways that you don't get in other places. But of course, seeing what the right is doing is important too. But, you know, the left in particular has had very divergent reactions, I guess, or had very divergent reactions, which is interesting because when you talk to people about it, it's generally the opposite in which people are very unified in clearly opposing what happened after October 7th with Israel and standing in solidarity with Palestinian people in the situation. And that's true. However, I think in my own view that the reaction, not in solidarity with Palestinian people, but to the actual events of the Al-Aqsa flood or October 7th or what you want to call it, was really interesting in that, and it wasn't a monolithic kind of reaction. So, you know, what stands out to me is the syncretic kind of anti-imperialist approach that some groups had, and that while Hamas was at the front of that, they had, you know, and before I go further, that's kind of like on a superficial level where a lot of the analysis was happening at. But there, unlike some other things that other modern events that were happening, maybe like Syria, there were deep historic roots of influences that were coming back up, right? So roots that already had organizations or had defunct organizations at this point, but either way had organized in the past in different ways. And going deeper than the past 10 years or 15 years or even 20 years and regarding Hamas, what interested me was looking at the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine or the PFLP. And its historic ties to the Soviet Union, the kind of history of left organizing in the United States specifically in terms of that dichotomy of the Cold War and influence of Soviet Union, I guess you could say communism, you have Marxist-Leninism, you have Trotskyism, you had Stalin apologists for a while. But long story short, throughout the 20th century, Soviet Union and its style of communism did have a big impact on organizing in the United States. If anything, because it was seen as the only alternative, it was kind of a black or white picture, or it was anti-US. And so if you're protesting the US, you went to that side. It's a very interesting dynamic. And I think that is something that I'm going to explore more, because I really think it's influenced a lot of culture in the Western left, that dichotomy of the Cold War. And it's influenced it in not only in kind of narrative ways, but in the actual organizations that exist and organizing of the past. But so anyway, talking about PFLP and that type of framing of what happened possibly in the Middle East, going all the way up through modern organizations. I might be mispronouncing it, but like Samadon, for instance, or more activist oriented public facing organizations that might be advocating for prisoners, for instance, but who are organizing protests that might have indirect ties, whether through its funding or individuals, et cetera, to some of these other paramilitary groups like PFLP. So that was something that was just very, I was very interested in looking at that and looking at objectively and just analyzing it to help explain in a deeper level some of the ideological, historical, and even, I guess you could say, cultural things that were happening within the left. Once you got past kind of like that, I don't want to say it's superficial in a way that's not meaningful, but maybe that surface level critique of, okay, so this is Hamas, this is what Hamas is, this is Israel, this is what Israel is, this happened on this day, and it was, you know, not good, and then Israel came back. There's a lot more to it, and there's a lot of arguments and undercurrents, I think, that at the end of the day, help explain maybe ourselves to ourselves as the Western left. We don't necessarily, it's not an agreement of it or saying this is what we are, but it's definitely a piece of a story. And it felt like I don't know. No one was talking about it. So that was one piece of what it was that I was looking at. And then, you know, I think that we all saw the rise of certain social media profiles under the guise of being pro-Palestinian. And, you know, they range from like outright anti-Semites, people like Jake Shields, that most people who, you know much of anything don't respect or follow. But other clearly compromised figures, you know, I think of Jackson Hinkle, for instance. Again, people who kind of like have any kind of knowledge of this don't take that person seriously. But I also think that there's a, it's too easy to dismiss the rise of these types of profiles and what they are, of course, which is, you know, not good faith, we could say. Yeah, there might be bots, and yeah, there might be paid people, and yeah, you know, they have their networks and their own trolls. But the huge spike in followers, whether totally legitimate or not, I mean, I think we know it's not totally legitimate, but still, fact of the matter is that those profiles were reaching a lot of people, you know, and they still do. And if you don't know these things, if you're just, you know, a common person, or you're not really invested in learning about the ins and outs of some of these, you know, secondary and you know, third place figures when we're talking about profiles and people, you might not know. And, you know, there's just, I think that people too easily dismiss the significance of some of these profiles. So it's, I found that interesting. Especially seeing kind of like who was following who and when people rose up. Of course, you know, at that time, this is a year ago. And since then, whatever flimsy mask that was on X is totally gone at this point. It's a Chan board, you know, with its head just out there saying ridiculous things. But at the time, it was more of an investigation into the syncretic nature of it and comparing it to what happened on the outset of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and, you know, what happened throughout the Syrian revolution, because there have been a lot of great work on that and the syncretic nature of especially social media, but authors, websites, and how messaging was sent through all these different tentacles or pathways, right? However, the messaging was very similar. It was just packaged and presented in different ways. I still think that both of those are really interesting topics that I would like to get more involved in. Again, I already have a hard drive, an exterior hard drive filled with stuff on it with screenshots and things. But along maybe with taking a deeper look at the Western left's relationship with certain parties in the Middle East and the kind of rise of these profiles that, you know, yeah, the people aren't serious people, but I do think that they're too easily dismissed as well, just for the platform that they've built for themselves. Along with all that, is that kind of syncretic nature of messaging that I was talking about, which I think is interesting. And of course, all of these are really huge topics, but I think the image of the paraglider was really interesting to me. The paraglider used by Hamas, of course, during October 7th, and how it was adopted as a symbol of resistance by many different groups, including left-wing factions. And for these groups, I think the imagery represented, you know, of course, defiance, right, against Israel, its military power, an underdog group of people fighting against a superior, technologically advanced military, and framed as a symbol probably of, you know, of liberation, you know, of oppressed people fighting back. So pro-Palestinian activists, I think, saw and see that kind of image as embodying other things too, like ingenuity of the oppressed in their fight for freedom. But at the end of the day, you know, it's a powerful image. And I think it goes back two, you know, we're talking about liberation of people, but at the end of the day, it's because if you're believing in that point of view, then you're seeing this as a colonial venture. And if you're seeing it as a colonial venture, it gets back to Western-backed imperialism. So seeing how that image kind of traversed these different ideas, and it goes beyond just that, was interesting to me. And, you know, that narrative was amplified by Hamas themselves in their own framing of the attack, in their publication called Our Narrative. It's a PDF. You can go out and find it. You don't even have to go on, you know, crazy Chan boards or anything to get it. It's out there. And in it, they present the operation as a direct response to systemic oppression by Israel. Really, it's countering the narrative that came out right after October 7th. So it was interesting to me how different groups used that imagery and how it developed. And there's a lot of analysis that, you know, would need to take place in that. And of course, that's just one symbol. It's not even actually talking about people or organizations or history. It's just an image. But I think one of the more, to me, like symbolic kind of views of this was looking at articles on Daily Stormer from Andrew Anglin, and how he wasn't even, you know, he does lots of cartoons and things, but, or I don't know if he does, if he hires someone, but he was just grabbing posts, social media posts from quote unquote, you know, like left-wing accounts, or there was one specifically from a Black Lives Matter chapter that I recall, and just posting them in Daily Stormer, basically like, yeah, we agree on this. And yeah, it's done in bad faith, but it was interesting to me that, again, I think that there's a immediacy to dismissing these types of things of, well, he's an anti-Semite, he doesn't care about these people, and that's all true, you know? But even within the right, there's some history and interaction with groups like this too. And I find the traversing of these, of the imagery interesting, because I do think that there's more below the surface as opposed to just trolling or superficial type of sarcasm. And so I did and go down that rabbit hole too. And it's a very nuanced path to go down. But the events of October 7th, I think, highlighted not only the immediate violence, but also, as I've been saying, these ideological underpinnings of the ongoing conflict and what that conflict represents in a broader sense. So, for instance, the collaboration between groups like PFLP or Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, in the Al-Aqsa flood, along with Hamas and other groups, and how that was repackaged in a more secular, I wouldn't say socialist, but definitely anti-imperialist narrative, even by groups like Hamas, probably with an eye towards, you know, like a Western audience. And, you know, PFLP and DFLP, even though they don't have much political power or necessarily manpower per se, but they're important because they're secular Marxist-Leninist organizations. And they're important, I think, for many reasons, especially for Hamas. But, you know, they've really position their struggles as part of a broader resistance against things that are more familiar to the Western left, like global capitalism, imperialism, intertwining national liberation efforts into these concepts with larger critiques of Western powers, whether it actually be the United States or, say, Israel, as maybe framed in this type of critique as like a client state, or not even Israel, even maybe allies in that region, like Saudi Arabia, for instance. So again, just things that I find interesting in looking back at the history of that, not even necessarily at what that means today, but at the influence that that's had, and maybe more so if that past influence has had any bearing on narratives that exist today, and maybe they don't. But it was interesting, again, because it introduced to a topic that had the surface level really been a discussion of very broad based generalizations of well, Hamas are Islamists or Israel is this or that. And this introduced more familiar concepts, I think, to the left, such as Marxism, decolonialization, as well, liberation topics. And for some observers, the fight was not solely a national effort against Israel, but again, it's more of a challenge against the West. And when we talk about the West, I think we start talking about like hegemony with Israel as a proxy for imperial powers. And these are the conversations that drive people crazy, which is what I'm really focused on now. I'll try to get to that later. I only have an hour, but and it drives people crazy, and it happened in Syria, and it happened in Ukraine. It's happened in other places, but it drives people crazy because it's taking the focus away from the people who are involved. It's even taking agency in some ways away from the people who are directly involved. And it's just blocking up the world into this like chessboard of international relations, of which most leftists really don't care about. You know, most people are interested in having solidarity with oppressed, regardless of who they are or where they're from. But I say most, not all. And you know, this gets especially tricky when you get into specific groups, and they're niche groups for sure, but they exist. So I think the framework has enabled the PFLP and DFLP to build strong alliances with leftist movements historically, including socialist groups, maybe back in the day, trade unions, organizations, again, like Samadon, who are more public-facing, who are leading protests against what's happening now. But definitely in the past, speakers and literature and those things cross-pollinated heavily. So, you know, it's helped maintain this Marxist-Leninist kind of ideology within global resistance. And that's really where the conversations, I think, get more nuanced and complicated for some segments, not all, but some segments of the Western left about what do you do with something like October 7th? So for some left groups, the tactics of Hamas were embraced, right, as a broader anti-colonial struggle. It doesn't seem as if many are trying to legitimize Netanyahu or Likud's right-wing coalition, but there is a rift of essentially, when you get down to it, two-state solution and one state solution. And even within one state solution, people saying this has to be done with revolutionary violence or this can be done peacefully. So it's a very fractured kind of view of things. And, you know, I mean, I think it, while it can get complicated in that there are many different groups and many different nuanced perspectives that they have, it is very basic. I mean, you know, there are, I think, you know, like heavy hitters. I'm thinking of like On Palestine with Chomsky and Pappy that are discussing one or two state solutions, really, you know, and even people like Chomsky, who's controversial, who I'm focusing on, coming out and having kind of like a vanilla take on this matter, you know. So I think inherent in that is a discussion of whether violence was justified in the context of decolonization, which again, that in and of itself is a whole critique to have of is this an example of decolonization or not? And, you know, this people saw it with, you know, different socialist and leftist organizations, you know, DSA, right, for one, you know, this really drove fractures through that group and other groups. And, you know, are you viewing it through like a Franz, like a Fanon, like a decolonization type of view? Or is this instead a reactionary, conservative, theological, religious group that came to power of dire straits of people who had been oppressed over generations and with leadership of the PLO that couldn't accomplish, you know, what the goal was. And so out of extreme despair, this reactionary group rose up. And there are plenty of articles from the left, the Western left, saying you can't have solidarity with Hamas. You can't have solidarity with these types of groups too. That schism is interesting to me because it exists, you know, and I think that a problem that, well, I guess it's a problem that the left has had is that that's also been something that the superficial or more mainstream media right has kind of jumped on. And of course with student protests, but so, you know, there's this fear of if you discuss it, you might look like you're kind of aligning with the right. And, you know, if you do in a certain way, sure you are, but I think that there is a good faith, you know, honest discussion to be had about all of these, you know, different fields or flavors or sections of the Western left. Again, whether we're talking about imperialism, decolonization, Marxism, Marxist-Leninism, socialism, anarchy, like anti-imperialism, you know, all these different things are have different ways to view it. And I, unlike many people, I really see that, you know, this fractured conversations within the Western left, as opposed to creating like a unified front. But that being said, I think that, and I'm kind of jumping to the end and I have more things to say, but at the end of the day, it kind of didn't matter because what ended up happening after October 7th with all of the devastation that's been brought by Likud, Netanyahu, and this far right wing Israeli coalition government did bring everybody together in the end. Because it kind of, and that's ultimately how this got sidelined, because it became so apparent what was happening weeks, months after October 7th, that October 7th was no longer a major part of the conversation, even though it was used as such for propaganda to continue this ongoing devastating war that is going to be interesting to see how it concludes. Reaching into other countries, reaching into other conflicts, bringing Syria into the discussion now. How much this mushroomed from October 7th into talk of greater Israel or now again, Lebanon, Syria. It's truly just, it's devastating and horrifying. But getting back to this, that's a lot about the left. And I went through it pretty quickly because these are things I'm going to come back to and investigate. But there's also the right to this as well, the right side of things, interpreting the attacks. And I think that there's a surface level to the right where it's interpreting attacks in like conspiratorial terms and using them to fuel anti-Semitism, anti-globalist rhetoric, reactionary narratives. I think that, again, many outright dismiss the argument as simply co-opting an anti-imperialist stance. And I think that we probably have some names of people specifically that we, you know, come to mind when we talk about co-opting anti-imperialism from like an obvious right-wing white nationalist, whatever you want to call yourself, perspective. But that exists. But there's also, again, a deeper analysis that's missing. Well, I can't say it's missing. It might be out there. I haven't seen much of it though. And that shared deeper analysis from the right, or at least syncretic kind of politics, to me, kind of dates back to national Bolshevist portrayal of the Versailles powers, you know, as representing the West. And even as Germany now being a part of the West is being colonized by the Versailles powers as justification, you know, for supporting ultimately what ended up being Nazi power. But and then looking through that strain of thought and how people have co-opted that strain of thought through different third position groups up to Dugin's fourth position theory, or even when he's talking in geopolitics about the Atlantic powers, there is a history that doesn't get talked about a lot of anti-imperialism on the right. And so if we don't look at what happened on October 7th as a liberation event involving secular socialist communist groups like PFLP, et cetera, and Hamas is like a multifaceted non-homogenous group that does have people who are will be considered reactionary and far right, but other people who are moderate and other people that are acting just within the government in different different places of power. There's a counter argument to that, or a different way of interpreting it, of saying these people are fighting for, you know, their religion. They are fighting for something of an ethnostate. They are fighting against Western imperialism, which is ruining and enslaving different cultures throughout the world, in that fourth position theory kind of argument of reactionary traditionalism against what I guess is called liberal imperialism, you could say, or Western hegemony. But again, there's history in that I find interesting, and there's history in the region too that I find interesting. Now, when I say I find it interesting, again, it's not the predominant narrative. So it needs to be put in proper place and in juxtaposition to other narratives. It's fairly minor, I think. But when you get into echo chambers, and when you especially get into, I think, social media, even things that in real life are you know, niche or kind of small can be blown up, you know? And I think that if you're listening to this, you've probably seen different ideas or versions of this. Yeah, so there's so much more, but I do want to move on. There's anti-authoritarian discussions that you could have again about both Likud as well as Hamas. Just lots of introspection, but I think that at what happened with this and why I'm going to return to it in the future is that we can't really argue about Israel's intentions at this point. And it's really my opinion that the focus needs to be with solidarity with Palestinians who are fighting for survival, as opposed to critiques about syncretic politics or misinformation or all these things that I find interesting, because that shouldn't be what's taking up all the space right now. And that shouldn't be what's filling the room and taking all the air out. So I put it on the back burner, and that's just kind of my personal opinion. It isn't meant to necessarily apply to other people. It's just what I kind of morally or ethically believed that now is not the time. So it's something maybe to return to in the future. Less about what actually happened, more about how people interpreted what happened, I suppose, if that makes sense. And that kind of led into the project I'm working on now. And so what I'm working on now is a book. I have no idea how I'm going to get it to anybody. I seriously doubt it's going to get picked up by, you know, a publishing house. So I don't know. It might just be something that I self-publish on Amazon, but you never know. But I do have an editor that I've been working with in Pakistan, and I chose them specifically because of different points of view and different, I guess, interpretations of things to kind of push back against some of the things I'm saying. But this is what's become of that Chomsky project. I've been saying, if you've been following for a long time, that I'm going to do an episode on Chomsky. And doing an episode on Chomsky is somewhat kind of foolish because if anything, despite the a critique that you could have, just the amount of work that that Chomsky himself has just put out there is so much, it's hard to say you're going to figure that out in you know, an hour or two. And so right now I have four chapters written, and it's a few hundred pages at the moment. I'm kind of in the middle of it, I guess, and it still needs a lot of work. I haven't gone back and updated the revisions yet. All the footnotes need to be done properly. Right now there's links and just, you know, linear notes to myself. So it's a big project and it's going to take a while. It's not, you know, a 150 page book. It's a really in-depth book, but without going into specifics about what it's exactly about, and maybe I will in the future when I get closer to it, towards the end, but it's similar in what I just talked about in discussions of October 7th, and that it's not necessarily about the person Noam Chomsky or even necessarily critiques of his books, let's say. It's more about what it means and what it means more broadly to the Western left and how that plays out in real time to actual events that are occurring. When it works and when it doesn't work and why. So that's kind of like the baseline for that. And it really started because I worked at a historical, I worked at a few different historical societies, especially when I was younger. One of them was a Ukrainian historical society. And, you know, through that, I just learned a lot about Ukrainian history and contemporary history too. I have an undergrad in history and I ended up taking a lot of Eastern European classes, Russian history classes. And so I just happened to have some knowledge in that area. And that's why I got so involved with the red-brown stuff and looking at Ukraine in the first place, because it was very obvious to me that a lot of these things that were getting put out there were not correct. They're just historically inaccurate. It's not even differences of opinion. It's just not true. And then, of course, all the propaganda and different layerings and complications that were put on it. And it's also what kind of got me with Chomsky, because when I was younger, I read tons of Noam Chomsky. I mean, I used to get his CDs. It probably makes me sound ancient, but I used to get CDs of his lectures from AK Press and listen to them. And what I quickly realized going back, you know, after seeing some of his comments about Ukraine and saying that doesn't sound like the Chomsky that I knew. Yeah, I realized that I had more of a peripheral understanding of who he was and what he did, because a lot of things that I knew about him or I read about him were specifically about anarchism and like, you know, like on anarchy or lectures that he gave about anarcho-syndicalism or Luxembourg or specific individuals. And of course, all the old dusty, anarchist theorists like Bakunin and Proudhon and stuff. And when I was like 16 or 17, that stuff was interesting to me. And it was really coming up because in the 90s, there's a resurgence of interest in anarchism, and especially combined with kind of an anti, not globalist, I for my own mind separate them, anti-globalization, which isn't the same as saying, anti-internationalism. And I think that all these phrases have somewhat, they're so loaded now, but it was against the concept of the decline of the Soviet Union and kind of a hegemony of capitalism throughout the world and what that meant to people here and what it was going to mean to people in other parts of the world in many different ways. So at that point, I was reading tons of Chomsky but I realized looking back, I hadn't really read a lot of his books. Instead, I was reading lots of articles and lectures and things like that. And, you know, especially some of his earlier works, that there are troubling things, we could say, that even at the emergence. And you all probably know what I'm talking about. But by the time we end up talking about Syria, it was as if I didn't even know who this person was. And so that's kind of what I'm writing about. Not necessarily the progression of Chomsky from he was good then and now he's bad. It's actually more of from a point of view of a reader, you know, reading Chomsky and coming to realizations that it's not just that maybe at one point he had it and now he doesn't, or he's old and he doesn't know what's happening anymore. Or that was a bad take, but he had other, it's really more about looking, trying to understand his ontology and Weber epistemology exists. He doesn't really have a political program. And finding very fundamental flaws in it when it's applied to challenging situations. And then reflecting back on what do those flaws mean in broader context? And what can people learn from that? With an eye, again, towards the Western left, not because I'm finger-waving people, but because I am a white guy from the United States that grew up in that tradition. So, you know, it's something for me in that niche to reflect on. I say that understanding, of course, that there are many different movements and many different things. But I do think that there are some flaws in the approach that some people have had, and that those flaws can be somewhat systemic in ways that disenfranchise people and lead us to these discussions about syncretic politics and red brown and why is Code Pink going to these meetings in Iran and why is David Duke there and you know, all these crazy rabbit holes that we can go down in the modern world of how is it that you get there? You know, like how, and I think with Chomsky, he's very good because it's a very, to me, a clear line of not someone who's totally ridiculous. He's not a Jackson Hinkle or something. He has a lot of truthful and good things to say, but also someone who's equally flawed. And how the flaws, because of his prestige and his significance within left institutions and organizations, are overlooked or even adopted, you know, by people without really drilling down into them to understand what they are. And at the end of the day, I think it's a kind of critique of anti-imperialism versus internationalism. And comparing those two things and really understanding what does that mean in 2025, right? What do these words mean in 2025? And possibly, you know, how do we get there? Are they corrupted or have they stayed consistent? Why not? So that's what I'm working on just very quickly. Of course, there's much more to it and there's lots of case studies and things, but a few people mentioned, I wrote an article about Trump. I've written a few articles about Trump, and it's probably redundant to people because you can go onto any mainstream media platform and read about how Trump is bad. But there are some specific things that people ask me about Trump. So I think one of the ones I got a lot of is, what does Trump mean to us, meaning activists, anti-fascists, people who are organizing on the left, or even just more broadly, more mainstream things, nonprofits, even, you know, groups that bring lawyers for undocumented people facing, you know, asylum and things like that. So I don't have like a presentation put together. There are some articles that I think have done a pretty good job of outlining the big picture things, but I had some like bullet points that I thought of that are important. Maybe I'll revisit, or maybe there are things just for people listening to go look at on their own. And the first was the Stop Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act that was passed by the House in November. So it had Republican backing, but enough Democrats supported that eventually, it didn't initially pass and then it passed. So, you know, it's raised concerns for a few different reasons. The bill would grant the executive branch broad authority to label nonprofits and activists as terrorists, a move that a lot of people see as being used to target groups advocating for causes like Palestinian solidarity specifically. But if we think back even to like the Bush years, I mean, there was one point when the greatest domestic terrorists are presented by the federal government were environmentalists, which is absolutely ridiculous. So with the Trump presidency, who knows? And, you know, this is something that just recently passed. Now, I don't know where it's going to go, but I think that you see more legislative efforts, not just extra you know, parliamentary type of things, or groups like Proud Boys and stuff like that. But I think that you see a lot more governments, you know, organized efforts to legalize this type of limitations on free speech and freedom of expression. Going through that, you know, I think that there are other things that tie into it. Just in general, thinking back to when Trump was in office, the increased criminalization of activism in general. And I say that in air quotes, because it isn't as if that has been happening under Biden as well, you know, and people have been following, you know, like Stop Cop City and things like that are well aware that this is, you know, I mean, you could go back as far as you want in U.S. history with this. But, you know, I'm thinking of maybe 9/11 as a big marker when we started talking about ways that the government could leverage institutions, maybe under the guise of national security, to limit the ability of people to practice their First Amendment rights. So I think left-wing activists, especially those involved in movements, you know, like Black Lives Matter, environmental protection, anti-war causes, all these different, you know, subsects of groups, are going to face the full brunt of whatever the establishment can brew up to levy against them. And I think that, again, people who are actively engaged in this work now already understand that, but there are going to be more protests, and people who aren't as experienced or seasoned in what to do and understanding of things like, you know, turning your cell phone off, like basic stuff like that, or what to do if you do get arrested, are going to need help. They're going to need to be informed and educated. And there are mainstream groups like the ACLU that help with that. But, you know, that I think is one thing. People who are unaware are going to be put in positions that they're not used to. And people who are aware are going to be put in positions they're not used to. Again, thinking back to Trump, I'm thinking of like when undocumented police cars in Portland were just throwing people in the back of them, but with police that had no uniforms on or insignia, you know, and bringing them to the stations and holding them. So situations like that. Going back to that legislation, I think restrictions on nonprofit funding is going to be a huge one. I think the Treasury Department is going to be a major focus on this. And I think that, you know, yes, there's going to be the right wing anti-government and Antifa into the villain type of stuff. But I think where you might see a lot of this is with groups that are trying to help women find access to abortion clinics, for instance, or like rideshare programs to other states and contraception through mail and things like that, that not just the act, but the people, the organizations that people are trying to use to facilitate these things in some type of central way, which I think probably, if that happens, then points to the direction of mutual aid, which was something that kind of became more popularized in, I don't want to say it's popularized in the mainstream, but it became more known, I think, in mainstream rhetoric under COVID. So, you know, there's that, something to keep an eye on with that. There's definitely going to be fear of speaking out and crackdowns on independent media. That doesn't necessarily impact activists per se, but you know, it might for researchers. And you know, so for instance, I don't know much about it, but recently, the Southern Poverty Law Center was criticized for gutting its Hate Watch group, who now have no full-time reporters or investigators. And, you know, I don't know if that was specifically because they're kissing the ring before Trump comes into office, or if it's a financial thing and these things just happen. It's the nature of nonprofits, because they are still, even though they're nonprofit, they still have profit motivation and CEOs and things like that. But, you know, I think that you might see more of that happening. And of course, that's going to indirectly impact people who are trying to do research on this type of thing. CrimeThink did a good article on this title, history repeats itself first as farce, then as tragedy, why the Democrats are responsible for Donald Trump's return to power. And while some of it, you know, you can agree or disagree with, I think it does a good job of highlighting some of the restrictions that have been put in place, even under Biden, that could be expanded upon and abused further by a Trump presidency. Trying to think if there's other things. Yeah. Those are the things that I highlighted. Unfortunately, I have a hard out. Along with all the things that, you know, I've been writing and doing, I also just happen to have a lot going on. I have a different job now that's very demanding. And I have a lot of things just going on, not negative, but just, you know, with I have a family. So there are just different things that are pulling me away. I have tried, though, to supplement these. I mean, you're probably listening to what I'm saying, going a million miles an hour, like, oh, my gosh. But it's because these are all things I've been working on. And I've been supplementing it with the Substack and the shorter articles. And some of them are kind of fun. You know, the Twilight Zone one was fun for me because I get to talk a little bit about, you know, what that means to me. And that's very nice. But there are other ones that are more in depth, like the In Times of Division, Unity is Our Mission. And you know, I think that's going to be important too. Because, you know, much like some of these other topics that we've discussed, which are huge big picture things that in the grand scheme of things, what the Western left or you or I think about it, that really doesn't matter. But, you know, something like opposition to Trump is important. And so I would highlight that article in Times of Division, Unity is Our Mission, because I had a lot of contentious discussions right around the time of the election and shortly after with people. You know, some people I grew up with that I'm friends with, other people that I've met through research or through activism and volunteering or direct action stuff. And, you know, I have to say that there isn't necessarily a monolithic wall or unified message in that. You know, when looking at even the things I was talking about involving October 7th and all the breakouts and the right and the left and syncretism and all this, to me, I think that the biggest takeaway, and it's a takeaway for some people's reaction to Trump too, is I think the rise of populist politics and the vague nature of what populism is. And to me, that's really something that I've come around on and I've began to focus on, not just within the US, but internationally and kind of historically too. I made a video a long time ago now where with on the concept of populism. But that was more of a historical view and understanding of it. And I think that sometimes, myself included, people who are doing research are very historically accurate. And especially when it comes to organizations that can be labeled or confused with the left, and that being so precise can, at times, I think, be a little detrimental because everything becomes atomicized into just marbles scattered over a table. And I think sometimes we can incorrectly try to draw lines that don't exist. Where when you're talking about something that's more vague, like populism, and I think you could tie it to the core concept of something like fourth position theory, you don't need necessarily to have everything have lines. I'm thinking of an article I wrote about the 1990s and syncretic politics, for instance, and the SPLC wrote an article talking about essentially pointing to like left and far right National Front unity in that. And it didn't seem to click. It didn't, you know, it seemed like it was a stretch of like, yes, these things existed, but I was there and there wasn't some overwhelming support. And even afterwards, it didn't pan out like the article had posed. And I think that you can run into that problem when you try to get too specific on things. I think that that's kind of the danger and the utility of populism, because it's vague, and in that vagueness, there's a lot of room for people to operate. And at that, I unfortunately need to stop. I'll make another video soon, maybe picking up on populism, because it kind of leads to a part of that article where I was talking. I was in communication with Rob Miller, who has gone off the deep end on the far right, and kind of seeing, just tracking what happened to him and juxtaposing that symbolically to, I think, a broader picture of a lot of people, maybe who didn't go so far off as him. I think with him, it's more of a, there's a lot of personal things that led to that, but I still did see a lot of symbolism in that, and a lot of self-reflection, myself, not to have any kind of allegiance with that, but drawing lines that don't necessarily exist in research to make a good narrative. I think that that's equally as dangerous as misinformation sometimes. So that's the time that I have now. I'm going to look at comments. Sorry, I didn't stop, but I wanted to get it all out. Maybe I'll revisit some things, but before I go, the Panama Canal, Chomsky's old Trumpism means right-wing authoritarianism, hardcore 19th century xenophobic nativism. Yeah, next future conflict is going to be between Israel and Iran. Yeah, there's a lot in these comments. Panama is something that's been in the periphery of my mind. I haven't focused on it, but you know, that's a very good observation. Maybe that's something I need to look at, because that's not necessarily something that's happened yet, but it's also something that was a little bit off my map. As for Chomsky's very old now. He's no longer in correspondence with people or anything. And yeah, Trumpism. Well, you know, Trumpism is it's going to be, I don't want to say it's going to be interesting, it's going to be horrifying, but I'm curious to see how he manifests power in his second term, understanding that he's only supposed to have 4 years, as opposed to his first term, to where he was looking at potentially 8 years. And if he maybe learned some things from his first term, just like other far right groups and activists learn from mistakes in the past. You know, I wonder if there's going to be a Charlottesville or something like that, for instance, or if those things are going to manifest in different ways, or if they are going to happen. You know, I don't know. Just thinking about the legal fallout and how it disrupted groups, et cetera, how that organization is going to occur. But on matters like that, you know, I'm not an expert, but those are things that I think about when I think about, you know, Trump and what it could mean. You know, he technically has 4 years. I say that because who knows what he thinks. But, I, you know, just from like a more civics and government point of view, he's going to try like hell to establish as many judges, as many laws, as many things as he can that'll be concrete and difficult to undo once he leaves. Especially if a J.D. Vance runs after him on some type of, you know, pseudo right wing, pseudo populist rhetoric mimicking successful or semi-successful parties in Europe, especially if regardless of what they do, the economy just tends to get better, you know, the further away it gets from COVID. These are all things that I think about. But they're also in that article. So I'm thinking next time I'll start maybe looking at the Syncretic Politics of 90s article and then maybe talk a little bit more about that Trump article and go back to Chomsky a bit. All right. Thanks for taking the time. I know I'm not very I'm not media savvy, and I'm not doing what's necessary to really, you know, build a podcast or something like that. But I do view this as a project. And once, whenever this book is done, I do think that there will be a series of articles and a series of podcasts and a whole lot of content coming out. So there's that to look forward to. All right. Thanks all.